Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. This is Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Peter Cookson, and we're going to talk about the Dr. Peter Cookson, and we're going to talk about the long-term effects of COVID-19. I have to get him on the line. Bear with me a minute.
Good morning.
Hi, Peter. We're on the air.
Very good.
This is Dr. Peter Cookson, and we're going to talk about the long-term effects of COVID-19. So I know you do a lot of reading about this. So tell us what you've found so far.
Among the things that I've found is what was originally reported were losses of smell and taste that persisted long after other symptoms of the virus went away. I personally experienced that in 2002 when I had SARS-CoV-1. And when I had SARS-CoV-2 this year, I experienced a persistent symptoms of dizziness without loss of smell or taste. However, I also experienced a dramatic loss of hearing for some time that has not yet returned or recovered. And the loss of hearing seems to be in the lower ranges. There are other people who have had more serious hearing losses as a result of infections with COVID-19. It's those symptoms that I'm referring to indicate that the virus has a ability, if not necessarily a propensity, to attack the central nervous system and those systems that are related to our senses, that is smell, taste, hearing, and balance. So it's my expectation that these symptoms will not only persist, but persist for an extended period of time. Personal experience, it took at least 6 months for me to get over the neurological symptoms that resulted from my original infection with COVID-1 back in 2002, which was called SARS. COVID-1-2002. Anyhow, I have not heard anything more than initial reports in the media that I'm tracking to indicate any persistence or increase in those symptoms. It may be a long time before that data is compiled. So that's a scary part of it. Who knows what else will be affected in terms of the central nervous system. I can certainly tell you that I have more difficulty remembering names and words when I try to conduct a conversation. And people tell me, well, I'm just getting old. Well, that's true. I am getting old, but something dramatic happened over the course of the last few months or so. So the virus has is looking for a place to live, and it's my opinion, based on how my knowledge of how the herpes virus can hide away in nerve cells for extended periods of time, up to 50 years, before showing itself again in the form of shingles. So I'm not saying that the COVID virus is a herpes virus by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just simply saying that that viruses are looking for a host to rest in for extended periods of time. And when they find it's appropriate, they will come out and spread to more hosts. This is how creatures survive in the world.
So, you know, since this is a brand new ailment, I want to use the word ailment.
Good.
The ramifications are unknown. So we can expect the unexpected. Would you agree?
I agree. Yes, definitely. Yeah, the data is not out, and the SARS-CoV-1 that we experienced lasted for a remarkably short period of time. It was much too virulent to last for an extended period of time. It killed off most of its hosts, and that produces a short exposure period, just 2 years or so. This virus is not as virulent. That is, it doesn't kill off the hosts as quickly as the COVID-1 killed them off. And so there will be a much longer period of time for this virus to produce long-term that will impair the ability of our young people to work, to conduct themselves in terms of mental acuity. That's a guess, okay? And I'm betting on that based on personal experience and also on reports from viruses that were involved in epidemics, for instance, 1918, 1919, for extended periods of time. So we don't know what the heck this virus is capable of doing. We've had too short of a period of time of exposure to the virus for us to fully appreciate how it will affect our society for extended, you know, for years to come, put it that way.
And I know you do a lot of reading, you know, on it because, you know, you mentioned you're retired. So is the medical community equipped to deal with everything that will be coming down the line?
Okay, pardon me. There are parts of the medical community with whom I have a great deal of confidence that they are working very, very hard to understand this virus and to help our health departments to deal with it with the general population. And so the medical community in the hospitals, I know very little about how they conduct themselves and how what they are doing. And so I'd rather not comment on what they're doing in the hospital dealing with people who come through the door with obvious symptoms of coronavirus or test positive and who need medical support, basically. I have some information about attempts to use a variety of different antivirals, and the literature that I have availed myself of indicates that there's only modest success in using those pharmaceutical products, pharmaceutically manufactured products. So I don't know whether it works or not. It's not clear. If they had a magic drug, I think we'd know about it. And we're certainly not hearing anything like that. There is a fellow who lives locally here out here in Schoharie County who has developed a drug that they're currently testing in Salt Lake City. Anecdotal reports of the use of that drug by local practitioners suggests or indicates that it is very successful in treating patients. I have no more information than what has been published in the local newspaper that is published in Cobleskill, except that there was a most recently this week that said we are now testing it in Salt Lake City and we have people who are being injected with or are using the drug. So that's all I can tell you. The people who are working very hard in the medical community are those who are engaged in developing a vaccine for this. I have my concerns about the vaccine. Most recently, that is yesterday, a highly regarded family practitioner in Cobleskill confided in me that he was looking after or taking care of a patient who presented some months ago with symptoms of coronavirus, and that patient was tested and found to be positive for coronavirus. The patient gradually recovered from those symptoms, and after discharge was tested again and found to be negative for coronavirus. Subsequently, on follow-up, doctor is very good about looking after his patients over an extended period of time, asked the patient to submit to another coronavirus test, and that also tested negative. Subsequently, again, on follow-up examination, the patient began to exhibit symptoms of coronavirus, and he tested that patient a fourth time, and that time the patient tested positive. So we conferred and realized that what had happened was one of two things. One, the virus was hiding and then suddenly reemerged after several months, or the virus had not provoked a protective immune response. And so when that patient was re-exposed to another attack by another virus, that patient got sick again, which is a very frightening outcome. So are the patients who are recovering from the an infection with the coronavirus adequately protected? If the answer is no, how can we expect that a vaccination, which is designed to stimulate our immune system, to develop or produce a system or produce either antibodies or produce blood cells that are able to recognize and eliminate a virus, if it doesn't work in an otherwise healthy person to catch the disease, how can we expect a vaccine to produce a response in a otherwise a normal person to produce a state in which they will be resistant to an attack? I am despondent over this new development, and doctor is aggressively pursuing the this patient's immune status in terms of serologies and white blood cell analysis to see exactly what has happened, if anything, or what is going on. And if this is
okay,
indeed,
now,
yes,
I've got a couple of questions. Well, first of all, you know, when you mention your area,
yes,
because this might go in other parts of the country, we're in upstate New York. You're a little west of Albany, New York, you know, so if anybody's listening, you know, the towns and areas that Peter is talking about is upstate New York, west of Albany. Now, the other question, I've got, and, you know, I think this is an important one because people talk about testing and whether they're going to be come out positive or negative, and it just dawned on me, how was this test created? Who created this test to find whether somebody's got COVID or not?
Okay, pardon me. The only thing that I can tell you about that is early on, the CDC developed a test that was reliable and specific. Subsequently, some political maneuvering occurred, and the supplies or the reagents necessary to develop a test or to support the particular test that the CDC had already devised were changed. That is, the supplier of the reagents was changed from the one that the CDC had determined to be reliable to another supplier. It turned out that using the reagents from this other supplier produced a test that was unreliable. Other than that, I have some information that a developer slash a researcher in England has developed a test that is based on an electronic device that senses the presence of the virus and is able to give you a report in less than 4 hours. I don't have all the details on that. I saw that on a special documentary on the television, and I could not find any further information on the internet regarding this. So all I can tell you is that good people are out there working on alternatives to the current testing processes that are used that are horribly delayed. With regard to the specific test results that doctor reported to me, I have to trust them at this point. We got two positives and two negatives. To lead with a belief that the tests are unreliable, then that's a no-starter. If you believe that the tests in this particular case, for instance, are reliable, then you must act on them. If you don't act on them, then you may be missing something that's very, very important.
Because, you know, the reason I pose this question is because, you know, for most of the people, and maybe in other parts of the world, COVID-19 just sprung up before our eyes with no warning and no basis of, okay, this is how it was in the past. So given that circumstance, you know, how did they come up with a test? And is the test accurate? And will it save lives?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, yeah, how did they know? Exactly. And how did they know way back then? What was going on? Well, I have some ideas, and it's based on my personal experience here in the community in which I live, and that is that there was a great number of children and their supporting staff in schools who developed severe flu-like syndrome in October, November of 19, all of clinical picture, the entire clinical picture of COVID-19. Where did that come from? And why was it presented then? And why were we not informed? Why did I get my disease in January, long before anybody was told that it was present in Albany, which is where I contracted it? What was going on? And the CDC had a test available long before then. Where did they get the idea to test for COVID-19? You know, that's a question that's, you know, for a political analysis of who's doing what to whom and who's developing this and how did it come about. I don't want to go there. There's all kinds of people who have ideas about where it came from, how did it get here, and is this really a natural event? It could very well be all of those, you know, natural, unnatural, or whatever have you. But the CDC was way out in front, as you suggest. And so it wasn't until much later when somebody said, my company has better reagents than yours, and you should buy mine. Anyhow, that's another issue, and I don't want to go there. I would
say... Now...
Yes, please.
There's... It seems that in a lot of states, it's spiking again. At the same time that it's spiking, people are becoming more and more blasé about this. What do you think?
Wow. Yes. True. And why do I think people are becoming blasé? Okay. Then I can tell you that around here, the people to whom I speak are mothers, and primarily on this particular topic, I speak to young mothers who have children, or who are also teachers, or who are who work in the school district in various capacities, driving buses, fixing lunches and dinners, and working in the cafeteria, et cetera. And all of them are very serious about how devastating this particular disease can be. Many of them have already recovered from a prior episode of illness that clinically is characteristic of COVID-19. They have not tested these people. And I would be curious as to whether or not their serology, that is a blood test to determine the presence of antibodies, would be. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Who knows? But when it did happen with that patient that our doctor here did do it, he found that at least the patient was able to catch the disease again, which is suggests very strongly that there was no immunity was built up as a result of the first episode of the viral infection. Scary. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Who are these people who are blasé? And the answer to that question is, I asked a friend yesterday. I visited with him 2 hours yesterday, and what his response, and there was another person who came along who was also involved in this system, was saying that there's a subset of the population who would be very negative about what the government or its agencies are trying to tell us. And so the government has lost the trust of a large segment of the citizenry, and it will be difficult for the government and its agencies to recover that trust. And so having lost that trust, these people disregard any further statements or advisories that our health departments or our government spokespeople put out there.
And they do so at their own risk, right?
Of course. Yes, exactly. Because there are good people in our government who are telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And they are advising us in as simple a terms as possible. What are the appropriate measures to take to protect yourself and your neighbors? And even at that basic level, the loss of trust that the government has developed, I don't know what the heck the word is, but anyhow, people don't trust the government anymore. Or there's a segment of the population that doesn't trust the government anymore. And I think those people are the ones to whom you're referring that are, quote, blasé, unquote, regarding this virus. They'll get sick and die. What, dear?
But people have not trusted the government for quite a while.
Agreed.
Right?
That's right. So this has been building for a long time. Yes. And so when they come out and they tell you that you should wear a mask and you should not go to parties or meet whole bunches of other people in closed spaces, people just say, oh, this is just more of the same untruths that the government has is putting out there for some other reason. And then when they find out that the people in the government have changed the source of the chemicals that are required to perform a reliable test, they say, see, they're doing it again. And the government just keeps doing it. So I don't know.
You and I have had a number of conversations on this radio show about COVID-19, and we will probably have some more. But between now and the time we talk again, can people expect? What can people expect?
In this community, and actually in the state of New York, the major focus now is on whether or not we should open the schools. The state of New York, using the information and the advice given to our political leaders by their appointees, which are in the health department, have decided to ask the local districts, the local school districts, to devise a plan that would enable them to safely open the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the word that they use repeatedly is flexibility. Each of the school districts must have latitude to develop a, quote, flexible program, unquote. And so the districts
mm-hmm.
have done that and done it well. And unfortunately, the bottom line is we are going to kick the ball into the court of the parent. And ultimately, it is the parent who makes the decision as to whether or not the child
wow.
will go to school, rather than the health department, rather than the political leaders, rather than the school district leaders. Ultimately, everyone is deferring to the parent. And,
mm-hmm.
and so then the parent is coming back to them and saying, in order to make that decision, I need more information. And the information
right.
that they're getting is confusing. And so the parents that I speak to here all say, I am not sending my children to school, period.
Mm-hmm.
And others saying, I am not going to go to school to teach. I am a teacher. I'm a certified teacher that the situation. Yeah, I read something this morning in today's local newspaper that they are one of the situations that they have devised is that in a corridor in a school, there will be traffic only in one direction. That is, the children can only walk from north to south. Have you ever been in a school when they ring the bell and they change classes? You know, give me a break. The children are just, you know,
right.
going hither and thither and this way and that.
Right.
And, you know, it unfortunately indicates that they don't have all the people who are devising these systems, even though they may be school administrators. I don't know. I don't think they've been down there in the classrooms, or they haven't been. We have preschool children here. We're talking 3 years old and up. What do you do with a three-year-old child? They can get sick, and they can be a spreader, no question about it.
Right, right.
So, you know, how are you going to do that? So this is going to be with us for a long time, and it's going to be very challenging, and there's going to be a lot more heartbreaks as time
you know,
goes on.
My last question for this conversation, when you say a long time, what time frame are you referring to?
Okay. Most a minimum of 2 to 3 years. Years.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
It can be as long as 10 or 15, but a minimum of 2 to 3 years
mm-hmm.
will be how long it takes. Go ahead.
When you say 15, you know, we're totally disrupted now. This disruption won't last for 10 years, do you think?
That is correct. Right. We are headed for a
okay.
total economic collapse. Your assessment is absolutely
okay.
correct. And that's exactly what happened in the first millennia after, you know, in 500 to 515 BC, not BC, AD. Yeah, there were
right.
Plagues or epidemics that lasted 15 years or so. And yes, they did accelerate the collapse of the Roman Empire, for sure.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
we are looking
so,
at the collapse of the economic system in this country, which was on, you know, which was in difficult
okay.
straits. Go ahead.
So we, the time is up for our conversation,
yeah.
and we will continue this at a later date. So
okay.
you have been listening to Dr. Peter Cookson. This is All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and if you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thank you, Peter. Have a great day, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.